Good afternoon, everyone. Committee, we are here on the, what is it, the 2nd of February, an auspicious day here at the Capitol. This is the Committee on Workforce and General Government, and today we're here for a public hearing on Senate Bill 1532, the minimum wage bill. Before we do that, though, we're going to have to go into a brief work session to adopt our committee rules, because this is the very first meeting of this committee during this session. So I'm going to open an organizational meeting of the committee. And Vice Chair Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules as presented.
Senator Thatcher moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. Those are dated something.
I'm sorry, they are not.
They are undated.
They are on OLIS.
Great. They're available on OLIS. They work off of our chamber rules, and they're the same rules that each committee has been using. So any discussion of the rules? Is there any objection to our adopting these proposed rules? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. Okay, I'm going to open our public hearing now on Senate Bill 1532, which is this was a bill that was introduced at the end of 2015, but in the form in which it was introduced, that it was first drafted, it was essentially a placeholder bill. And at that time, it was looking at dealing with the minimum wage according to three different regional schedules. As many of you know, there have been a lot of conversations since then, and it has been sort of concentrated into two regional schedules. And those changes are embodied in the Dash 1 amendments. And those amendments have been available to you all on our information system, our electronic information system. And those are the ones that are current. And they have two regions, one for the state as a whole, and then one in the Portland metro area within the Portland urban growth boundary. According to a schedule that you can find in the bill for the statewide increase, and then a dollar and a quarter higher for the Portland metro area. Anyway, for us to have a better understanding of the bill, I'm going to call up for our first panel two people from Governor Brown's office, who were very instrumental in getting us to this point with this amendment. So, Ilana Guinea and Vince Porter, would you please come up? And Vince and Ilana, if you could introduce yourself for the record, and then tell us, sort of in broad terms, what we're dealing with here, and then if members have questions, we can go into them.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ilana Purtle Guinea. I work for Governor Keith Brown. Thank you.
And I'm Vince Porter, and I also work for Governor Keith Brown.
The governor sat down before you all a few weeks ago to present her proposal for raising Oregon's minimum wage. And since that time, we have received substantial feedback from stakeholders, which led to this updated proposal that you see in the Dash 1s of Senate Bill 1532. Since taking office, the governor has expressed her support in raising the minimum wage. She's been clear that in any increase, she hopes to see a policy that takes into account the needs of different parts of the state, a policy that provides an adequate glide path for businesses to prepare, and a policy that is significant enough that it makes a difference for workers, their families, and their communities. We believe that the Dash 1s do just that. The proposal before you today gives minimum wage workers in Oregon a raise in July of 2016. That's earlier than any previous proposal we've seen. But it also creates a long, slow glide path that adjusts the differentials between areas within the metro urban growth boundary and those outside to take into account two specific concerns that we heard since introducing the governor's original proposal. First, the concerns of rural communities that the original proposal raised the wage too quickly at the beginning of the time period. And second, the concerns of those communities bordering the higher wage area. Vince will go over specifics of the proposal, and we're both happy to answer any questions you may have. Additionally, we've submitted for the record a report which we hope you have all received from the Research Division of the Oregon Employment Department, which provides a significant amount of data and context for our conversations around the minimum wage. With that, I'll let Vince go over the specific proposal.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. So one of the things I would want to just put out is we talked to a lot of different people as we were putting through the various proposals and internally. And one thing that became clear from those conversations is three basic principles that we've tried to keep involved as part of this. One is to keep it as simple as possible, provide elements of certainty for businesses over a long period of time, and then also maintaining a statewide authority on the minimum wage. And so through the process, we've looked at various different scenarios. We always try to keep those three things front and center in terms of our thinking. I do want to just quickly, if it's okay, walk through just what is in the Dash One amendments. The proposal here has us starting in July of 2016 with a 50-cent increase from the statewide, and a lot of that is due to the fact that we did not see an increase to the minimum wage in January. So this would propose that we would go to $9.75 both at entirely statewide. Then in July of 2017, we would begin the phasing in of the Portland urban growth boundary differential. And in the first year, it would just be a $1 premium over the $10.25 statewide rate. In the bill, we do call out each year, but if you'll see, beginning in July of 2018, when we go to $10.75, it becomes a $1.25 premium in the Portland urban growth boundary and takes us all the way till we get to July of 2022. Where it would be $13.25 statewide and $14.50 in Portland growth boundary. After that, we would then go to the CPI index with always the $1.25 increase in the Portland growth boundary. So I just wanted to make sure, because I think that's the way it's spelled out in the bill, and there's that one point in July of 17 where it's only a dollar differential, but that was intended to bring a phase in of that differential in Portland.
Okay, thank you. Members, do you have any questions about the proposal? I have one. The proposal, the question of the urban growth boundary and that region, the amendments give Bureau of Labor and Industry some rulemaking in implementing this bill. One of the questions that will be asked is, how do you treat employees who are, maybe they're traveling in and out of the area to do their work? And, my expectation would be that Boley will treat this in the same way that we intended in the sick leave law, SB 454 last time. And that is, if the business to which the worker reports is located in Portland, but then they do work outside of Portland, they come under the Portland metro rate. Whereas if they are located in Woodburn, and let's say they come into Portland to do, some landscaping or delivery or, whatever, they would be under still the place where they report to work. Does that, I don't know if that came up, but that would be my assumption.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, that's not a conversation that came up in our work with stakeholders, but it is an important conversation to have moving forward. Boley is given the jurisdiction for the rulemaking process in the Dash 1, so I don't want to wade too far into what that should look like. But we would assume that there would be some conversation around place of work and location of work center, absolutely.
And I'll just say, you know, in many ways, of course, I prefer my original concept because it was my original concept. But I do recognize that enforcement would have been a lot more difficult under, you know, what's in the original bill, which would have three regions and different phase-in rates for large employers versus small. This is much simpler, and, you know, I think it does fit with those values that Vince laid out. Yes, Senator Kelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your work on this. If this measure were to pass, and then a ballot measure were to pass in the fall, I understand that the ballot measure rate would supersede whatever the wage rate was in here. What about the premium for the Portland area? Is the bill constructed so that if it's superseded by a ballot measure, there isn't that additional premium on top of that ballot measure wage?
Chair Denbrough and Senator Gelser, it's a good question that we ought to get clarity on. Our focus has been on that this would be the minimum wage rule law moving forward, and in exception to any other ballot measures. So we hadn't really thought through if there was like something, but we should probably follow back and get back to you on that.
Can I?
Yes. Probably.
Thank you. Clarify. So your understanding is that it would still have that premium on it without amendment here?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Gelser, I think what I was trying to say is we were under the assumption that if were this to pass, that this would be the minimum wage policy for the state moving forward, and that there would not be other issues to consider. So this is a point we have not discussed, but we should follow back and make sure that it's addressed.
We'll check with the Legislative Council. My understanding is that the ballot measure would supersede in all ways this, but we can check on that.
And it would be helpful just to get that clarified with certainty on the record.
Great.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing us this proposal, which is similar but different from the proposal that we heard from the governor. But I wanted to follow up on the chair's question a little bit about the UGB Metro aspect of this. So the urban growth boundary is not intuitively a boundary that anybody has ever thought about applying to wages. Mm-hmm. And so that's a new concept, although I think people are getting more used to it, having heard it over a period of a couple of weeks. But I wanted to just ask you to talk a little bit about what would, I guess, two questions. One is for workers who don't even have any idea that there is an urban growth boundary, because it's not really something they have to worry about when they're worried about putting food on the table and paying the rent. How will people know whether they're inside or outside that boundary? That would be one question. I guess the same question for employers who would also maybe not be paying most attention to that. And then secondly, if the urban growth boundary were to change, which periodically it changes for reasons unrelated to wages, how would you see this proposal fitting in with efforts to expand the urban growth boundary, which, you know, seems like a perennial discussion?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Rosenbaum, I think there are two questions there, and I may take the first one and let Vince answer the second one. As we put this proposal together, we were trying very hard to figure out what the best way was to think about the difference between urban and rural areas, which is why, of course, we landed on the urban growth boundary, the metro urban growth boundary specifically. I think that there will need to be some amount of education done after this proposal passes, or if this proposal passes, to ensure that both workers and employers know what side of the urban growth boundary they are on. Luckily, this is an issue being heavily covered by the media. My hope is that press coverage will help to raise awareness of the issue to some extent. I know that our Bureau of Labor and Industries has some provisions already in place for employers to call in with questions about how various employment laws affect their business. So I assume, although I can't speak for them, that this would be one of the things that employers could call in and ask Boley about as well. My hope is that the various organizations who work with workers in the state and have been involved in helping to provide feedback on this proposal would be doing work with their memberships as well to make sure that as many workers as possible know what their rights are, just like we need to make sure that as many businesses as possible know how this affects them as well.
And Chair Denbrough and Senator Rosenbaum, to the second question, really, we had a lot of discussion about boundaries and, you know, should it be a city boundary? And that didn't seem sufficient from a lot of input and others, so restricting it to a city was problematic for us. But at the same time, expanding it out to something like the Metropolitan Service Area or Service District did seem to pull in more parts of the region that we really didn't intend or want to have or think that it was appropriate, that it was really going to be necessary to have a premium hourly wage in those parts of that boundary. So the alternative was the urban growth boundary. Now, we've also had a lot of conversations, Alana in particular, about land use policy, and we're certainly not interested in letting this dictate a land use decision or policy. So we'll be open to continue to have that conversation so it doesn't somehow affect a secondary policy.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, well, on behalf of the committee and, you know, all of us, I want to thank you for all the time you put into this. You and, you know, people from you know, worker advocates, business community, everyone who, you know, who tried to come together and help us get to a better place. So thank you both very much.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, I'm going to be calling up. So let me just say something about what we're looking at. We have too many people here signed up to get through the 2 hours. And this is the priority that I'll be using. First of all, we have a couple of elected officials here, and it's our practice to call them up first, and I will do that. So if they could head up here, Roger Nyquist from Linn County and Roy Lindsay from Grants Pass, if you could come up. And as they're coming up, the next group that I'm going to be calling up are those who came when we last had a public hearing. As you know, we've had a number of public hearings on this issue. Our last one was during our legislative days in the middle of January. We had a long night hearing. And there were just too many people there. There were a lot of people who came from more than 100 miles away, and we accommodated all of them. But there were some who were closer in who we didn't have a chance to hear from. They're going to get first priority, those that we know about. And then we'll start bringing up people as they signed up. So, yes. Mr. Nyquist and Mr. Lindsay, please, at your leisure.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, for the record, Roger Nyquist. I'm chair of the Linn County Board of Commissioners, testifying on in that role this afternoon. You have a document before you. You have a couple of them, I hope. She's passing those out now. Yes. And they highlight the origins of Section 15 of the Oregon Constitution. Measure 30 was passed back in 1996, in large part motivated by county commissioners who, after the passage of Measures 47 and 50, were trying to figure out how they would balance their budgets going forward and get control of their expenses. Measure 84 in 2000 passed with over 80% of the vote. And if you'll go to page 6 of the document I gave you, it highlights Section 15 of the Oregon Constitution. And what that section basically says is that in the event that the Oregon legislature doesn't fund a new program or an increase in a program, local government doesn't have to participate. So if you pass this minimum wage program and you don't fund it for local government, it's our interpretation that Linn County doesn't have to participate. In addition, if you go to page 7, then on section 8, it talks about competing businesses and says that any business competing then with a local government not participating in a new program is not required to participate either. So we do a lot of things in Linn County, and there are a lot of areas that would lead to question of whether or not private sector had to participate. The easiest, cleanest example is RV parks. Our Parks Department operates those. There are private sector RV parks around who compete directly with us. Our inmate work crew does all kinds of things that competes with the private sector that likely would fall under this provision as well. We give mental health counseling, A&D counseling. Our Parks Department runs a restaurant. So you can see the complication for us, the potential complication. The next area I would direct you would be your legislative fiscal report that you have on this matter. I think in general does a good job, except when you get to the numbers. It defines very, very narrowly direct costs, and those aren't the costs. The costs are substantially higher. If you go to page 12 of that, page 12 in my little handout, it's not page 12 of the report. It refers to effects on local government, and it says that they have very little data. And the reason you have very little data is nobody's talking to us as local government. So if you have a mandate to fund this program at the local level, we ought to be having those conversations so you know what the impacts are. I then would move you to have you go to page 15. In summary, that I've got some areas highlighted there. The last line, the last sentence on page 15 of what I would call the summary, says that a lower minimum wage is generally preferred. And some level of higher wage might be okay, but it doesn't say at what point it then would become harmful. I've also included for you the CBO report from the Congressional Budget Office. And one of the really scary things about this proposition, this legislation, is the rate, the total rate at which you increase the minimum wage. It's almost 50%. The CBO report estimated that if they move the federal minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $9 an hour, that it would cost 100,000 jobs. But then they project out at $10 an hour, it would cost 500,000 jobs, 500,000 to a million. So as you move up another dollar, is it just another 500,000, or is there a multiplying effect there? I don't know. I hope some economist does and can give you the answer to that. The other thing that not addressed in the way of dollars and cents of your legislative fiscal report is the compression issues and the roll-up costs through our wage scale. If anybody thinks that if you move the minimum wage up to $15 an hour, that those folks making $15 an hour to $18 an hour aren't going to want and receive more money, they've not done any contract negotiations or run a large organization. That's just how it's going to work. And so to that end, we attempted to calculate at the county what this legislation would cost us. And so if you'll go to page 21, actually on page 20, and so the process was I got together with the county administrator and the county accountant, and we projected what we thought the dollar amount that would flow through the system in higher wages to other employees, and we landed on a number of $2 an hour. We think it will cost, and we think we'll be lucky to negotiate and get to that number throughout our pay scale. $2 an hour, and we have hours worked in the county of 882,876 hours. So we did the math. We then add the payroll costs, and we come to a dollar amount of $2,222,728. That's just for us, Linn County as an organization. Now, if you'll come to the next page, this is just my study, not that of an economist, but it's the only study you have before you today in the way of impacts to local government in any kind of detailed way. So if it's $2 million for us, we represent about 15% of government activity in Linn County. So if you take that number and multiply it by 6.7, you come to almost $15 million. Linn County is about 3% of the state of Oregon. So then if you take that number, almost $15 million, and multiply it by 33.3, you come up with $495,912,844. I'm certain that number is not right. There's a range there. But the point is, the implementation of this new program will cost us a lot of money. We're not in the position to pay for it. And we think, based on the Constitution, we're not required to participate, and we likely will not do so. And thank you for your consideration and the time to speak before you this afternoon.
Thank you. Mr. Nyquist, please.
Yes, my name is Roy
Lindsay. Oh, Lindsay, sorry.
Roy Lindsay. I'm a city councilor in Grants Pass. I didn't find out until late last evening that I was coming, and so my remarks are somewhat sketchy.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Measure 5 and 50 limits the ability for local governments to raise revenue. We all know that. Costs of providing services under this bill will go up. We know that. Local governments will have to reduce services to compensate for that rise. They cannot raise revenue to match what is being added to their costs. So they have to reduce services. And that is a struggle that local governments have all the time. As costs go up, how do you match the budget and still maintain services? And oftentimes, services have to go. The impact upon society as a whole is going to be significant. We know that. Costs for goods will rise, especially in the retail and restaurant business. Grants Pass has a very large restaurant activity, a modicum of retail based on its size. We're a tourist area, no question. Seniors on fixed incomes will not be able to go out as often for dinner as they usually do if their cost of meals goes up in a restaurant. That will reduce the activity in the restaurants, and obviously they will be reducing the amount of food or closing or reducing the number of employees that they have. That's a logical conclusion. And we have a large population of seniors on fixed incomes in Grants Pass. It's considered to be a sort of a retirement haven. This is, from my perspective as a city councilor, this is not well thought out. And this is what I call an example of emotional logic rather than sound financial economic logic. Those already on welfare will need to have an increase in their welfare revenue based on the fact that costs are going to go up. They're going to demand it, and rightfully so. So that's another hidden or, shall we say, ancillary impact on what is going to happen. And we have a large number of people on welfare in Josephine County. It's considered to be the poorest county in the state. And we have a lot of welfare recipients. It's going to impact them as well. I have a saying that I have used for many years. Intelligence without wisdom is valueless. Wisdom is vitally important in every aspect. And we in local government try to use wisdom as much as possible to see every angle, to see all the impacts and to understand what effect the ordinances or resolutions that we have is going to have. We have to do that in order to service our constituents. And so I'm against this because the impacts far outweigh any advantages that might be achieved. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Did you have
I don't have a question for them, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. My question is actually for you.
Yes.
Based on what Commissioner Nyquist indicated, did you know of any LC opinion as it relates to the Section 15 argument?
We have not done an LC opinion on this, but we certainly will look into it. We have LC in the room if you'd like to ask them, or if you would prefer a more considered response, that might be.
Well, let's call them up and see if they have an answer.
Well, Mr. Chair, I actually was going to ask the witnesses a question about exactly that point, but I suppose we could ask legislative counsel.
Okay.
While they're coming, can I ask my commissioner a question?
Sure.
Is it your belief that the same issue would apply to a measure passed by the voters?
No, it wouldn't. If this was referred to the voters, the constitutional amendment, Section 15, applies to the Oregon Legislature. It wouldn't apply to a measure passed. So, and we have talked with counsel. We do have legal analysis on this. Be happy to forward it to you.
That'd be great, Mr. Chair. Shouldn't we get that into the committee?
Sure, that would be useful.
Thank you.
If we could get that. Ledge Counsel, could you just come up and give us a brief response? Thank you.
Chair Dembo, members of the committee, I'm Ted Reutlinger from Legislative Council, and with me is Gail Stevens, who is the author of the bill. The local mandate provision of the Oregon Constitution, which is Article 11, Section 15, does, by its term, require the legislature to, if the legislature requires a local government to establish a new program or to provide an increased level of services for an existing program, then the state must pay the cost of providing that service. There is a big exemption in that if the legislature passes a bill by a three-fifths majority, then the counties, the local governments, are obligated to comply with the state law. However, this section of the Constitution does not, by its terms, render any law that you pass unconstitutional, nor does it require anything more than a simple majority to become law. What it does mean is that you might have to provide funding or pass something by a three-fifths majority in order to prevent a local government from ignoring the law. There aren't any court cases on this. It was passed originally in 96 and reaffirmed by the voters in the year 2000. If you were to pass this bill as it is, without providing funding and without providing a three-fifths vote, it would then be up to the local governments to decide whether or not they are going to comply with it. And I think what you just heard was that at least one county is going to take the position that this section does in fact apply to an increase in the minimum wage. However, there aren't any court cases on this language. It is broad, and the question legally would be whether or not an increase in the minimum wage would require local governments to either establish a new program or provide for an increased level of service for an existing program. And as you know, lawyers will argue about what does program mean, what does service mean. Program is defined pretty broadly in the constitutional amendment itself. Obviously, people can differ upon the interpretations of this. We have not issued a formal opinion on this particular issue, but a court, what they would do is they'd look at the text, they'd look at the context, and if they couldn't determine the voters' intent, they'd look at legislative history, which could include the voters' pamphlets, other contemporaneous things like editorials and the like. I suspect that ultimately a court would likely decide this case if counties chose not to comply. The section in the Constitution does prohibit cases against the state itself, so it could end up in court if you were to just simply pass this without a supermajority and without the accompanying funding.
Thank you. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and far be it from me to try to discuss the law with a panel of very capable lawyers, but I think, and you alluded to it, Ted, is that having a minimum wage, particularly a statewide minimum wage, is by no definition a new program. Oregon has had a state minimum wage. I think we were the first state in the entire nation to adopt a state minimum wage back in 1913. So simply adjusting the amount of the statewide minimum wage, which already goes up every year under current law, doesn't seem to me to fall under any definition of a new program, though I get that lawyers can go into court and argue whatever they want. But I just don't see how you could say that having a state minimum wage would be creating a new program.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, I suspect the better argument for a local government would be to argue that this requires an increased level of service for an existing program. And then the discussion devolves into, is this in fact a program as it's defined in the Constitution? And it could get further involved in, you know, does that program mean a local government providing wages to its own workers, or is it a broader interpretation or a more narrow interpretation of just providing services to the public? Either interpretation is potentially valid. The language of the Constitution is fairly broad. And so my main point right now is that it's subject to interpretation, and we don't know the answer at this point.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Gelser.
Thank you. So if it's subject to interpretation, the way that we would get the answer, you said it would be determined by a court. How long would that process last, and what would happen to wages in that period? Would they be paid if the court decided in favor of the state? Would back wages then be paid?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gelser, it's difficult to tell how long it would take for a case to reach the court, and once it reached the court, how long it would take to get a decision. I suspect a case like this might wind its way up through the appellate courts because it is a case of first impression in a section of the Oregon Constitution. I think ultimately it would be up to the court to decide what would happen with respect to the back wages, depending on what decision they made. I suspect in the meantime, unless somebody was able to get an injunction, I suspect that the local governments would pay the wages that they wanted to pay, irrespective of the law, assuming that they chose to ignore the increase in wages.
And a follow-up?
Yes.
So what about the piece about the competitors? What kind of so would that mean any restaurant, any child? I mean, what are the parameters on that local government, and what tools would BOLI have for enforcement of wages and determining what's a competitor with a local government and what is not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gelser, that's a very difficult question because this is a highly unusual provision of the Oregon Constitution. It applies to what is defined as enterprise activity, which means a program under which a local government sells products or services in competition with a non-governmental entity. And then it goes on to say that when a local government is offering services that compete with non-governmental entities and they relate to these enterprise activities, then the non-governmental folks don't have to comply. That's really complicated, and we don't have any idea at this point how broad a court would interpret that language. It could have a broad application. They could narrow the definition down to a small subset. We just don't know. And really, this is the first time that I've ever heard of this particular issue coming up publicly.
Okay. Thank you both very much for providing us with that perspective. Senator Knope.
I just have one final question. Yeah. So you would say that the statement is correct, that if a ballot measure were to raise the minimum wage as opposed to the legislature, this section doesn't apply. You would agree with that?
Correct. Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Knope, this section only applies to laws adopted by the legislature.
So it would be safest, if you want to raise the minimum wage, to do that at the ballot, not through the legislature, based on this provision?
Mr. Chair, Senator Knope, depends on your definition of safest. You wouldn't have to worry about the legislature appropriating money to pay for any local government costs if the increase was passed by initiative.
Ted, you sound like a lawyer.
Yeah.
A lawyer for a long time.
Yeah, but just to repeat, there's no constitutional prohibition against this. It's a question of funding, and that could potentially, depending on how a court case played out, laying additional requirements upon the legislature.
Mr. Chair, I think that's essentially correct. You can pass this law. You do not have to provide funding. You do not have to have a supermajority. That path will likely lead to counties choosing, or are they any other unit of local government choosing whether or not they want to comply, and if they do that, it could lead to litigation.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I see we have a couple of other electeds here, and so if the two senators would please come forward. And we're going to have to limit testimony now to just 2 minutes, if that's okay. That's for everyone else. We have a city council member from Kaiser, Amy Ryan. If you're here in the room, please come. If you're in an overflow room, please join us.
Thank
Senator
you.
Senator Thompson, welcome.
Chair Dembrough and committee members. First of all, I'd like to start out, if I only have 2 minutes, I'm going to talk really fast. I've got a proposed amendment that exempts ag and forestry to this bill. It would be the dash four. I've got a letter from a fellow pear grower in Hood River.
I'm sorry, Senator Thompson. If you could please.
Chuck Thompson, District 26.
Thank
do
you.
Do I get those 4 seconds back? friends of mine from Hood River that farm 100 acres, what this would do to their, and by their estimates, what it would do to their operation, their total payroll last year was $500,000. The increase from the minimum wage at the top end of this would raise it by $200,000. I think what a lot of people don't understand about this bill, and maybe it's been said already, but what I haven't heard a lot about this, but this raise in the minimum wage will also affect everybody's workers' comp, payroll amounts, tax amounts. So their workman's comp cost them around $50,000. With this increases, you're going to add another $20,000 besides the higher minimum wage. Their payroll tax was $160,000. You're going to add another $50,000 to that. That adds up to $210,000. So instead of paying $710,000 in total wages and payroll taxes, it's going to be over $1 million. You've heard me say this argument many, many, many times. Farming is different than the rest of business. If you own a McDonald's store and you have to pay higher wages and your food costs are higher, you can raise the price of your hamburgers and still be competitive with the McDonald's next door. Farmers, we don't have that option. We put all the costs into raising the fruit, whether it's fruit or lettuce or any kind of a crop. It's a worldwide market. We don't set our price. It's all on supply and demand. It goes to the warehouses after we pick. They pack and ship them and sell them what the buyers are willing to pay for them. Then Safeway gets to Safeway or Rosars. I'm not picking on Safeway. They buy them by a certain price. They get to set their price, and they don't care what it costs us. We're not going to get any. Okay. We can't
Senator
recover
Thompson.
Any of these costs.
Yeah.
And then I have
That's
one.
Right.
You can't yeah. deny this little cute story. A gal that I coach softball with emailed me today. You have to give me the opportunity to do this. Thank you. I knew you would. I am a young farmer. This will be my fourth crop during the 2016 session. As a young farmer, I am trying to justify staying in farming as a profession. This minimum wage increase makes the decision more easy for me to make. I simply cannot afford to stay in the game when labor and will take even more in the expense column than it already does. Some may reply that I am not large enough operation, and that is business. I know I am not the only young farmer. How many other young farmers will this wage increase push out? I full-heartedly agree that people should be paid a deserving wage, but I can't help but feel that lawmakers and others don't understand that many fruit farms in Oregon give complimentary housing, electricity, water, and garbage to their employees. I feel farmers cannot take the wage increase and provide these living benefits that these workers have grown accustomed to. We love our employees. We love Oregon. We love being farmers. We hope that others see the importance of keeping family farms. I'll skip a little bit.
Actually, I think that'll have to
and,
be it.
So. Well, you have to hear the last part of it.
All right, one sentence. And we're taking the
time
off of Senator Olson.
Thank you about the future of farming here in Oregon. Hugs to my favorite softball coach. Yeah, so, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Ryan.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. My name is Amy Ryan. I'm here as a Kaiser City Councilor. This is my first time to testify, so I'm a little bit nervous, but I'm not speaking on behalf of my fellow councilors or the city. I am speaking on behalf of the people of Kaiser and local business. So what I would like to just reiterate, as you'll hear today, there's a lot of numbers and a lot of facts, but I want to get it down to the bare minimum of how the bill affects our local communities. And I think that's really important that as we have heard of how it's affecting local business, it's also affecting the businesses who are recovering from a recession. And this is a very difficult subject. As we look at this bill, it greatly increases our cost of business to stay in business. It increases our taxes. It increases the cost of local services. These costs will impact our local communities and families. This increased minimum wage will put lower wage workers out of a job. And I would like to remind you as a committee that this was never intended to be a living wage. This was a starting point when you were a kid and you got a job at McDonald's and you had to start somewhere so you could get an education or a trade. So I'd like to see that we could maybe move towards supporting those programs. But that being said, before we put our local businesses out of work, I'd like to remind you that we are a community that multiple people have worked very hard to get to $15 an hour, and yet the cost of living will go up to affect those people who have worked so hard to, that they started from minimum wage, and those are the people that I speak to often. I also want to share with you, we recently held a town hall in Kaiser, and it was well attended. We are a very business-friendly community, and we are really fighting for our local business. That being said, we need a grocery store desperately in Kaiser. This will affect and hurt bringing local business to our smaller communities because it's a cost of doing business that we really can't afford, and it will hurt our business growth. All of these facts that you're hearing today, not only the business and the costs, but also it affects, as you've heard, our seniors and our fixed incomes, and that's something that we can't ignore. I also want to remind you,
if you could conclude.
Yes, sir. Yes. I'd also like to remind you that it affects our local families who are recovering from a hurt economy, and that this this business is not just hurtful to local business, or excuse me, this bill is not just hurtful to local business, but also our local families.
Thank you very much. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alan Olson. I represent Senate District 20, the heart of Clackamas County. The value of any wage corresponds directly to the value that a person provides to the operation. Wages are predicated on an employer base. As we have a very small employer base, we have many employees competing for jobs, i.e., we have lower wages. More competition by employers for labor drives up wages and benefits. We do not have this in Oregon, and we, the legislature, should work for this goal. Many will talk about the impacts in the state. LRO states that an increase of $2 an hour would lower income growth in the long run. A very noted economist says that once fully implemented, an increase in the minimum wage to $13.50 an hour would reduce Oregon wage and salary incomes by approximately $6.2 billion, with a B, dollars. We know that there is a nexus between unemployment and poverty, and Oregon has the highest poverty rate on the West Coast. When we lose jobs because of these bills, we will exacerbate an already high poverty rate. Teens and other low-skilled workers will be the most adversely affected by these increases. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, all three of you.
Yeah.
Do I have time left?
You do. Okay, so if we could bring up Kurt Huffman, John Zielinski, Gary Peck, and Shelley Beauchert Davis, please. If you could, come up. Just come on up. There may be some who are in the overflow rooms. So we'll get started with you. Are you Ms. Davis?
I am.
Great. Okay, we'll start with you. If you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Senator Dembrough, thank you. My name is Shelley Beauchert Davis. I'm a third-generation Oregon farmer, international businesswoman, former single mom, currently mom of three daughters. One is here because she's sick. and also the daughter of a truck driver. We export ag products as well. Today, I'm a beggar of your attention. I do have a story. I've submitted testimony, but I do want to point out a few things that I found interesting in the Legislative Fiscal Office Budget Information Report. They outline some ideas on how to deal with the minimum wage increase for our workers. One would be reducing production hours, reducing the total number of employees, absorbing labor costs by increased worker productivity, raise prices, reduce other costs such as fringe benefits, and accepting lower profits. So these are my options. I can fire people, I can reduce their hours, I can make them work harder, I can raise my prices, which isn't an option when you're talking about international business. I can take away their benefits, or I can accept lower profits. So I'm in the farming industry, and we learned from my parents and my grandparents, you save for a rainy day. That's what we do. There's some good years and there's some bad years. We have to have profits in order to continue from year to year. We have 48 employees, and in order to continue, we have to have those profits. Some years are better than others. This year is not one of them. So I had an idea to put it this way. So if I go to the doctor and they tell me I have high blood pressure, I'm going to believe them because they're the professional and they have, let's say, a lab analysis or something to prove it. So I'm sitting here as a farmer and as a business person. I'm the professional, and I do have an analysis. In fact, your office put it together, and I'm saying we can't do this. Categorically, the rural Oregon business community and the farming community is saying we cannot do this. Please believe us. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Davis.
Chairman Denbrough, members of the committee, my name is Kurt Huffman. I have a business in Portland, Oregon called Chef's Table. We partner with chefs, and we open their restaurants. We currently have 18 restaurants and employ 450 people across the city. We'd like to think that we're a small contributor to the food scene in Portland, and one of the reasons that the Washington Post just named Portland the best food city in America. My concern with the legislation, or the proposed legislation, is that in the absence of tip credit, I think it has unintended consequences relative to pay disparity within the restaurants themselves. So we have, over the last 3 years, have a internal objective in our restaurants of getting everybody in our kitchens up to $18 an hour. We've just opened our first two restaurants that have introductory wages at $15 an hour and increased wages to $18 an hour. And currently, the two restaurants I'm speaking about are at $18 an hour. The problem with the wage increase as it's legislated or as it's proposed is that in the absence of tip credit, it mandates a pay increase for our best paid employees. Our tip earning employees currently make $25 an hour at the lowest, up to $75 an hour at our busiest restaurant. In that context, it is incredibly difficult for us when we're seeing a $6 per hour increase on our staff that are already making $25 an hour to pursue an $18 an hour minimum wage for our kitchen employees. And tip credit, on the other hand, would still allow us to pursue that in what I think is a noble objective. I'd like to think that we're, in fact, outperforming what the legislature is proposing in terms of a minimum wage at $18 an hour. But in the absence of tip credit, we will be unable, without a massive increase in prices, to achieve that. The second wrinkle I'd like to propose is that restaurants like ours and throughout Portland have a unusual purchasing philosophy, which is that we choose and prioritize working with Oregon products. And
you could wrap up, Mr.
And those products are going to be disproportionately hurt and impacted by this wage increase. So specifically, we work almost exclusively in the summer and fall times with Oregon farms. This is not something that our competitors, our national chain competitors, do, nor do they pursue. So we're going to be impacted at the restaurant level that have purchasing philosophies like ours, both on the input costs and the output costs. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Huffman.
Chair Denbrough, committee members. My name is John Zielinski. I farm just northeast of Salem here with my two brothers. We grow pears, apples, peaches, hazelnuts, and we have a farm direct market. Though we have a farm direct market, a majority of our pears and apples and hazelnuts, 85% of them, are shipped out of Oregon. This is typical for Oregon, with an average of 80% of all Oregon ag product being exported to either foreign countries or another state.
When we ship our fruit out of the state, it is already at a slight disadvantage due to Oregon's higher minimum wage. If the minimum wage is increased to $13.25 or the other various proposals, our apples and pears and all of Oregon's agricultural bounty will be at a severe competitive disadvantage. My neighbors just down the road grow blueberries. Their biggest competition is Michigan, where the minimum wage is $8.15 per hour. A neighbor on the other side of me to the west grows nursery stock. Their biggest competitor is Tennessee and North Carolina, where the minimum wage is $7.25 per hour, the federal minimum wage. Labor is the greatest expense for these farmers, and their competition will be paying just at half of what they pay. However, Oregon does have some rather significant numbers that, farmers are a small percentage of the population. It is difficult for us to have an impact through our numbers on your opinions. However, ag does have some rather significant numbers that you need to consider. Ag provides 326,000 full or part-time jobs, over 13% of employment in Oregon. Ag is directly related and indirectly related to $50 billion in sales of goods and services. Marion County, my home county, $630 million in farm gate sales. Ag, food, and fiber account for 10.9% of all Oregon exports for a total of $15.2
billion. Okay, Mr. Zielinski, if you could just wrap up.
Okay. Over 200 crops are grown in Oregon. We do not have a monoculture of the Midwest Corn Belt where they ship their product and it's just a... If you enjoy seeing fresh berries on the table in your markets, all the other bounty that's here, make sure that we can still grow those crops. We wouldn't be able to grow those crops. You will see a big shift in crops in Oregon if these measures go through.
Thank you very much. Thank you, all three of you. We have two more individuals who were here last time and didn't get to testify, Britt Conroy and again, Gary Heck, please. Oh, and Anna Scharf, if she's here, she also didn't get to testify. Mr. Peck, please start.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Deborah, and the members of the committee, and thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Gary Peck, and I'm the owner of a small business in Oregon. My wife and I own and operate six card and gift shops throughout the state. We have stores in Portland, Tualatin, Salem, Corvallis, Eugene, and Bend. And we started our business in 1992 with one store and have grown over the last 25 years to these six stores. I wanted to say that we're proud to be business owners in the state of Oregon. I'm a native Oregonian, was born here in Portland, and have lived here my entire life. And we have employees that have been with us since the 90s that we care very much about. And just to let you know, just for our small business, last year we used 35,972 hours at minimum wage. And just taking a look at what the proposals are today for in 2017, this would mean an increase in cost to us of over $60,000, and that doesn't include the changes for mandated sick leave as well as the increases in payroll taxes. Now, we're a low-margin business, so we don't have the ability to really cover those kinds of costs. So what happens for us is that stores that aren't able to make it in this kind of environment will have to close, and our other stores are going to have significantly reduced operating hours in order to be profitable. I'm concerned because that's going to impact some of those long-term employees that we've had for quite some time. And the other concern I have is that I'm afraid that Oregon might end up just being a bunch of big box stores without any small local retailers like myself left in the state. And just the last point I'd like to make is a higher minimum wage is good as long as you have a job, but there's going to be significantly less jobs in our business. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Peck.
Chair Dembrough and committee members. My name is Anna Scharf, and I'm here on behalf of Scharf Farms in Perrydale, Oregon, which is out in Polk County. Scharf Farms is a family-owned and operated business, and we've been in Oregon for almost 100 years. It's managed to survive the Great Depression, recent recessions, and ongoing increases in government regulations and unfunded mandates. But recently, the challenges seem a little harder. The Affordable Care Act, mandatory sick time, and now a minimum wage increase looming. We are a medium-sized farm with an average of 17 employees. We have no employees currently earning the minimum wage, but several that are below the proposed increases. In addition, we have skilled and very talented employees that have been with us for 35 plus years. They're going to have a hard time understanding why I'm now going to go out and hire inexperienced, limited skills, and language barrier employees at such high rates of pay. Shouldn't they also get a pay increase? An increase in minimum wage on our farm will mean that some people will lose their jobs. It will mean that, again, we will adjust our way of doing business because of government decisions. We simply cannot absorb a 24% payroll tax increase. How are we going to do it? A robotic palletizer is going to replace 2 to 3 employees. Our existing mechanical grape harvester is going to replace 40-plus pickers during grape season. And we're going to adjust what we grow, making sure that we use what needs the least amount of labor. The majority of agricultural crop revenue is global priced, and we cannot simply raise our prices to generate more revenue. Yesterday, the governor came in and said how she went to Asia, and she enjoyed the opportunity to see and promote Oregon products in those regions, how great it was to see Oregon wines and nuts, etc., on the shelves. I wonder how many agricultural products will be eliminated from those markets by an increase in minimum wage. Please think about the devastating impacts that this will have to Oregon agriculture and what Oregon has to offer. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Scharf. Perfect. Mr. Connery.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Britt Connor, and I am Public Policy Associate for Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. EMO is a statewide organization of over 140 religious denominations, congregations, and direct community service providers representing rural and urban communities throughout the state.
Yeah, these microphones are really sensitive, so you can be a mile away.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Or it'll feel that way.
Currently in Oregon, a worker earning minimum wage at a full-time job cannot make enough to provide housing, food, and other basic necessities for her family. The need for an increase in the minimum wage is supported by sobering statistics and by the stories of clients EMO programs serve every day. Nearly 1 in 7 Oregonians did not have enough money to buy food at least one time in the past year. Indeed, at our Northeast Emergency Food Program, we regularly provide groceries for children whose parents work full-time. 1 in 4 Oregon mothers with young children work in low-wage jobs, the second highest rate in the country. Our staff at EMO's Russian Oregon Social Services Program, ROSS, sees this reality daily. ROSS helps domestic violence survivors obtain skills that enable economic self-sufficiency. But when a victim of domestic violence feels she must stay with her abuser because even her full-time job cannot support her and her scared children, we have erected a barrier to a better, safer life when there should be a bridge. EMO, as a statewide organization, requests 3 things of this committee and this legislature. First, raise the wage so that families in rural Oregon are self-sufficient. Second, establish a wage structure so that acknowledges there are real cost of living differences across our state. Third, stand strong in the face of pressure to create exemptions for certain employers from a new statewide minimum wage. There are no exceptions to human dignity, none to whom our values do not apply. Where an industry needs help to survive, we must choose policy approaches that do not result in our most impoverished neighbors bearing our collective burden. A minimum wage increase will mean stability and much needed hope for many. Thank you for giving this issue your time and your thoughtful discernment.
Thank you very much, Ms. Conroy. Thank you, all 3 of you. And by the way, everyone, know that many of you have submitted written testimony. If you haven't, you certainly can, and we encourage you to do that. We have, I think, one more person who was here last time, Mr. Glenn Stonebrink. And then after that, I'll be calling up Melissa Unger, Ramon Ramirez, and Graham Traynor, please. Please, Mr. Stonebrink.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome.
Chairman and committee. My name is Glenn Stonebrink, and I submitted some testimony earlier And in that, I did, I won't elaborate here, but I did want to let you know that I spent the first 29 years of my life in poverty. So I know what it is to work hard and do without. Currently, my wife and I own four restaurants in the Salem area, the Rock and Rogers restaurants. And I did some data checking this morning. And in one of them, we generated almost 21,000 hours, which was, and if you increase that by the 2.25, I just use that number as an approximate. It'd be, and in all four restaurants, that'd be $188,000 that I have to come up with that I don't have. So any increase, I will tell you now, I can't raise my the cost of my hamburgers, as was stated earlier, enough to cover that whatsoever. In fact, the sick leave law that you passed last year is going to cost me $26,000. I don't know where I get that either. So my choice is only one. I will have to quit. Now, I can retire, and that's fine. But my nearly 50 employees will be out of work. And I know those like my children and their children. And there's a lot of them. And they are needing these jobs, but they will be unemployed. My customers, a lot of them are, we're like the 50s type diner. A lot of them are elderly people who are on fixed income. They won't be able to, if I were to increase my prices to cover these costs, they wouldn't be there. So they are my customers, my employees is why we're in the business. So I beg you to reconsider the unintended consequences that may go along with this. And I would prefer that you let the market and the unemployment and the minimum wage seek its own level. We're the second highest, as you know, in the nation now. And what is the emergency that we must be considering now under this emergency session that's driving this? I have no idea. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stonebrink. Okay, the next panel, please. Melissa Unger, Ramon Ramirez, and Graham Traynor. And let me say to the audience, I know this is frustrating for our colleagues. We have a lot of questions and comments that we'd love to ask, but we want to hear from as many people as we can. So go first, whoever.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. For the record, I'm Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director for SEIU Local 503. We, Local 503 and SEIU Local 49, represent over 65,000 workers statewide who work in a variety of professions, including caregivers, state workers, janitors, hospital workers, and more. And I want to talk about the differences in the policies, but first I want to talk a little bit about my family. My husband and I, we have a three-year-old son and a child care center in Portland. Our child care center is great, but it's not that fancy. It doesn't serve organic food, doesn't do anything especially special. We pay for 3 days a week, $1,170 a month for child care. We're about to have another child in May, and at that point, we will pay $2,000 a month in child care expenses. For 3 days a week, it'll cost us $24,000 a year. Being able to put your child in daycare that fits your needs should be something every parent can achieve. But with extremely high costs, it's unaffordable for most. For someone working at minimum wage, it'd be impossible to afford quality childcare. And with programs like the employment-related daycare, only serving one in six eligible families, it seems like people are never going to be able to achieve this. And I tell this story because even with the rates we are talking about today, childcare centers will be completely unaffordable for parents, even if you have two full-time working families, full-time working people. You know, over half of Oregon counties have a self-sufficiency wage that is over $13.50, and seven counties have a self-sufficiency wage is over $20. The self-sufficiency wage is defined by the University of Washington as a wage that just to make ends meet. Put food on your table, put a roof over your head, like nothing fancy, like going to the movies. That would be not included in the self-sufficiency wage. And by 2022, when this program fully phases in, self-sufficiency wages will continue to increase, and all counties will be over the rates that we are talking about today.
Our members have endorsed both ballot measures, 15 Now and Raise the Wage. We've been very active in the Raise the Wage Coalition, where we have worked to raise the wage to $13.50 and lifting preemption. If this measure was to pass, using the average CPI, the statewide wage would be $14.77 in 2022. We wish we were here today talking about that. We're not.
If you could wrap up.
Yep. Sorry. We appreciate the governor's leadership in finding a path to meaningful increases for wages for workers. While we don't think this proposal gets us quite far enough, we do believe it'll be a meaningful increase for workers who need it. Just that 50 cents in July 2016 would put over $1,000 in people's pockets in 1 year. And for people who are trying to make ends meet and make less than $20,000 a year, that matters a lot. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Unger.
Welcome, Chair Dembrough and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ramon Ramirez. I'm president of the Oregon Farmworker Union, PECUN. And we are here on behalf of our 6,500 members in support of Senate Bill 1532, the -1 amendments that support an increase in minimum wage for all workers, all people that work in the state of Oregon. We are strongly opposed to -4 amendments and the exclusion of farm workers and youth from making minimum wage. You know, the bottom line is that the majority of farm workers in this state and this country are Latinos, right? 99% of the farm workers are Latinos. And for too long, we have done an injustice to the farm worker. We have not paid them due. What they were the ones that put food on our table day in and day out, right? And I agree with my fellow colleagues who are farmers that, you know, Oregon agriculture is beautiful. It's a industry that's rebounding right now. You know, we have surpassed $6 billion in gate sales overall for the first time in our history. Yet farm workers have not benefited from that. I brought two farm workers who are youth, whose parents have worked in farm labor for 30 years and are still making $9.25 an hour, right? That's an injustice, right? And we are here to support the -1 amendments because we think that we got to correct that wrong. We cannot exclude anybody from making minimum wage, at least the farm workers. These are America's most important workers because they're the ones that feed us day in and day out. I just want to reiterate that we are not in competition with other states like North Carolina and Idaho because those folks are using guest workers. Those folks have to pay an adverse wage effect rate, which is way higher than our state minimum wage. For Idaho, it's $11.75, and for North Carolina, it's around $10.38 an hour. If you factor in that these workers have to be housed and they have to be provided transportation, the minimum wage for those workers, and we're talking about tens of thousands of folks, is over $15 an hour. So, and to end my testimony, I just want to thank the governor for all the hard work. I was part of the negotiating team that came to this disagreement, and you know, we bit hard at the apple. I know that business did too, and so we think that this is this proposal's a step in the right direction. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ramon. Graham. Thank
you. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Graham Traynor, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO, the statewide federation of labor unions, representing over 300,000 working Oregonians and a voice for all workers in the legislative process. We appreciate the attention to this issue. As many know, our organization has long been on the front lines of raising workplace standards for all workers and believes that a critical component, no matter what others might say, to any agenda addressing economic inequality must include raising our state's minimum wage because we believe that no one who works full-time should live in poverty in Oregon or anywhere. In addition to being a part of the Raise the Wage Coalition, as my colleagues here have talked about, that has built a campaign and filed three ballot measures, we've also signed on as endorsers of the 15 Now campaign here in Oregon, and the Oregon AFL-CIO additionally has been engaged in conversations led by the governor over the last few months to find a path to a legislative solution with some pretty clear standards and principles that have guided these efforts. That includes ensuring that all workers, no matter where they live, no matter what corner of the state, get an adequate raise, that we find ways to address the high-cost regions around the state and the need for a minimum wage in those regions that reflects the cost that workers in those communities face, and not leaving workers behind like agricultural workers and tipped workers. I do want to just make sure, take a moment for folks to remember who we're talking about in terms of minimum wage workers. The average minimum wage worker is a 35-year-old mother. More than half of minimum wage workers are women, and two-thirds of Oregon women are breadwinners. 60% of workers at low wages work for businesses with more than 50 employees, and the annual salary currently of an Oregon minimum wage worker is just over $19,000. So, as others have said, it's no surprise that our organization and the Raise the Wage Coalition like other options and alternatives better. But we believe that the Dash One amendments in front of you have been a compromise between both sides that, frankly, some of we like a lot, some of it we don't. And one of the things that we like others have said, is that it gives a 50-cent raise to workers before a ballot measure could ever do that. And we hear on and on from workers that this is a vitally important component, and obviously we look forward to continuing the conversation with both the legislature and the governor to give workers a much needed raise this year. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, all three.
Mr. Chair,
of you.
I have a couple questions. Thank you, Melissa. Is SEIU going to continue to try to pass the 15 now ballot measure?
Chair Dembrough, Senator Canope. I think that one, what will happen this, we kind of have to figure out what happens this session, right? It's the second day of session. So I have no idea what's going to be the outcome of all of these conversations. So that will depend on it. Our members, I think, have had lots of conversations about how this goes. And after what happens at the end of session, they'll take, you know, they'll look and consider where we go from there. I think we have not been actively involved day to day in the 15 Now campaign. We have signed on, and we signed on about a year ago.
What about you guys?
I think the same goes. I think we're in a position where it's early in session. I think a lot of conversations will happen in the next 3 days. And I think our process will include a board meeting after session to reevaluate. I would also just say that while we have signed on to the 15 Now campaign, our organization hasn't been involved in a day-to-day effort, but has been long involved for the effort to raise wages in 2016.
Thanks. Okay, thank you all. All right, Jeff McNierney, Mike Oates, and Sean Habak. I'm going to make sure we get all the people who've driven more than 100 miles or were driven. So if the other two are in another room, why don't we start with you, please? Welcome.
Chair Dembrough and the committee members. Pardon me, I'm not a polished presenter. I'm just a small employer from Southern Oregon in Josephine County.
Okay, if you could just give us your name for the record.
My name is Sean Hoback. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
I run Wild River Brewing and Pizza Company down in Southern Oregon. I'm also a senior board member on First Community Credit Union's board and the treasurer for that organization. As a small employer in the brewpub industry, I've seen the failed effects of the past 20 years of minimum wage increases, particularly in Josephine County. Doubling down a failed policy at this time in our recovery is the worst possible thing for our Oregon workforce. We've already seen massive investment by Oregon chain restaurants to divest of entry-level and service staff workforce and replace it with technology. This isn't just happening in Oregon restaurants, but nearly every industry which uses entry-level employees, from agriculture to manufacturing, from the service industry to transportation. Oregon is leading the future in replacing our workforce with technology. The states that are innovating and developing, exporting and creating, are not having minimum wage discussions. They're having tax reduction discussions, infrastructure development discussions, and all the positive discussions that come from a thriving, capital-driven workforce. In these states, the workforce is prospering and the poverty level is shrinking. Few work for minimum wage, and those that do don't do it for long because capital pressures drive the wages up, not political partisan legislation. Minimum wage, in my opinion, will further reduce actual spending power for working families with children. And I'm citing a Thomas McCurdy February 22nd Wall Street Journal article. Reduce total statewide wealth from shrinking export and industry development. Reduce workforce incentive to grow and improve professionally. We're lowering the ceiling. If we're raising the floor, the ceiling's coming crashing down on our workforce. We're going to destroy more entry-level jobs for untrained or high school first-time job seekers. We're going to signal to employers that are waiting to grow or to lay off. Increase technology spending to replace skilled workers or to replace unskilled labor. Increase the number of part-time jobs with fewer benefits, increasing the social welfare expense. It'll cause Oregon to be less attractive to new business and industry and cause further destruction of the family
as parents must each work multiple part-time jobs. I can assure the Senate Workforce Committee that my small business will have fewer employees earning less total wages in the coming years if this legislation moves forward.
Okay, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, next, if you could. Hi, welcome. If you could just give us your name for the record.
Committee members, my name is Jeff McNerney. I'm a farmer from Hood River, Oregon. I haven't prepared any fancy papers or anything. I'll just give you a real quick. I'll talk
tell
fast like
your,
Chuck
just
did.
Tell us your thoughts.
Okay, so as a grower in Hood River Valley, we grow pears, apples, cherries, and blueberries. And the main crop I'm going to talk about right now is blueberries. We planted blueberries in 2007, and we hand harvest them with around 100 people. And right now the profit margin is so close that we're debating whether or not to go to processor and just machine pick them. We're keeping hand harvesting. And if we go to this increase in minimum wage and I have to raise all the wages, I'll likely go to processing the whole crop. And eventually we'll probably take the blueberries out because we're not making a lot of profit on those. We'll stay with the other ones. And one thing I wanted to address real quick was one of the previous speakers talked about the Latino workers and how we're taking advantage of them. They're all in poverty. We have 14 full-time people that work for us. And those 14 people, they're all paid typically on an hourly basis or a piece rate basis. None of them are on salary, but their yearly earnings for 20, and I just remember from doing all the work, their yearly earnings from 2015, the low was $26,000 a year. The high was $45,000. And the $45,000 guy, they're all Latinos. They're all uneducated Latinos, and they all have housing for free. And those are the guys that run our farms. But when I have to give all the new workers that come in that are untrained, an increase up to 13, whatever it is, well, my guys that make me money, they're going to get raises too. So we're not taking advantage of them. They have good family wage jobs in our valley. We take care of those people. But eventually, if it keeps getting tougher and tougher to farm, Hood River Valley is a real tourist town. We all know that. Eventually, as farmers, young farmers, we'll figure out a way to start getting rid of the EFU and we'll sell it for tourism. And we'll quit growing fruit in Hood River Valley in Oregon. And we may end up moving to other states to try to grow produce, but we're stuck with the dirt. But if we can't make a profit, we're doing something different. And we will quit farming Hood River if we have to eventually.
Thank you for those thoughts. Mr. Oates?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. My name is Mike Oates. I'm a grower also in Hood River. I've been worked in my first orchard 52 years ago. I have a degree from Oregon State University in agricultural economics, and I've done many cost studies over the years concerning the pear industry. The minimum wage that we now have, as we all know, is fairly high. The only one higher is Washington. And lucky for us, they're our biggest competition for our products of pears and apples. So it hasn't been too bad. If we get a situation where ours goes up a lot higher, then the competition gets really tough. I mean, as it stated earlier, we are in an international market, but for the United States, Washington is our competition. With the minimum wage, it sets a floor. No one on our farm makes minimum wage. Everyone makes more than that. It's all driven by economics. And it's been good lately. Things are working well. But on the other hand, entry-level jobs and minimum wage was only meant for entry-level jobs and initial jobs. From there, it's supposed to go up. If you have the job or the cost go up to these extremes, I don't know how we're going to have entry-level jobs at all. With this increase, we're going to have two choices in our industry. We can either figure out a way to get our prices up to cover those costs, or we can get out. And either way has a bad influence on inflation. If we have less product, costs go up. If we raise the price, the cost goes up. And I'm really concerned, it's been said a little bit here this afternoon, who's really going to affect is like senior citizens who are on fixed incomes where their CPI regulates how much increase they get every year. If we start increasing minimum wage, which is going to increase the floor for everything and increase everything up higher than inflation rates, it becomes inflation. And it doesn't solve anything.
Thank you very much, Mr. Oates. Thanks, all three of you. Great. Phil Bentley and Lori Santenspiel And Chris Gerard, please.
Mr. Chair, could I just make a comment for the record? So several people have been saying that Oregon has the second highest minimum wage in the country, and there's no reason why people should keep track of this, but I think the committee staff and members and people in this room should know that that is not the case. As of January 1st of 2016, I believe there are at least seven states and the District of Columbia that have higher minimum wages than we currently do at 925. So,
yeah, I think we're number nine. Okay, Mr. Gerard.
Chair Demborough, Vice Chair Thatcher. I'm Chris Gerard, CEO of Plaid Pantry and Chair of the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association. I hope you had a chance to review the testimony I submitted, particularly Dr. Fruit's update for the Dash 1 amendments. His projection now for that is 62,700 jobs lost. I have the unfortunate responsibility of accounting for about 145 of those jobs that will go away under this bill. That's a small slice, but they're important to me because it's my employees, and most of them are really long-term employees. I've talked to legislators about this. I've talked to Republicans, and I've talked to Democrats. And everybody recognizes that there's going to be worker displacement. They're even concerned about it. They think there should be a plan, but they recognize there isn't. And then I get the comment, but we have to do something. Well, no, you don't. Not if it's the wrong thing to do. Worker displacement is a pretty sterile euphemism. What we're doing is creating more poor people. There's been no analysis of that. It should be in that equation. We're pulling numbers out of the air, $12, $13.50, $15.52, $14.50, $13.25, with no quantitative analysis on how many people is that going to lift out of poverty, and how many are going to be put into poverty, and where's the balance? And then you can make a rational decision on whether you're helping or hurting people. There's talk about businesses can adjust, but in my testimony, you talk about businesses that are very profitable down to good businesses, down to marginally profitable, and there are good businesses down there paying wages and a lot of expenses and economic activity. If you, and they might be able to increase their revenue 2% a year, but if you increase their biggest expense, compound 6.6% a year for 7 years, it's not a question of if they're going to get in trouble. It's just a question of when. I hope you really think about this and have somebody analyze what the impacts are going to be. Good economists look at what is seen, but they have to foresee what's happening. And LFO and LRO and Eric Fruits, please pay attention to that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gerard. Mr. Bentley.
Chair Demborough, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, my name is Phil Bentley with the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent more than 700 providers of long-term care services and supports in Oregon. These services include independent living, in-home care, assisted living and memory care communities, and skilled nursing facilities. Our members care for tens of thousands of seniors and people with disabilities each day. Our members employ more than 40,000 Oregonians in a variety of positions, including licensed, certified, and non-certified direct care workers, food service, laundry, facilities, and administration. Labor constitutes roughly 70% of our fixed operating costs. Our workforce includes some minimum wage workers, but most of our employees currently earn more than the existing minimum wage. We've been monitoring this conversation on the minimum wage increase, whether it's going to occur at the ballot in November or here in the legislature. And I have to say that we believe that it would be preferable, if something is going to happen, to have it be done here in the legislature. We think that the proposal before you is an improvement over the ballot measures, which would be frankly devastating to our sector. We also believe that a conversation in the legislature allows for an equal commitment to fund the increases in future biennia. And I can't stress strongly enough how critical and how important that is going to be. And I want to talk just briefly about how a proposal to raise the minimum wage like this will affect our sector. We basically have three primary sources of funding: the private pay market, Medicare, and Medicaid. Increased labor costs will be felt by consumers in the private pay market. For example, increased costs for independent living, maybe the increased costs for staying in an assisted living facility or contracting for in-home care services. But in the Medicare and Medicaid market, we don't set our prices. Frankly, you do in the Medicaid arena. The federal government does for Medicare. We have contracted with Portland State's Northwest Economic Research Center to do a study. We will be presenting that information to you when it's available. We do think this is going to cost somewhere in the neighborhood of at least tens of millions of dollars per year and potentially more than $50 million per year.
Thank you, Ms. Bentley.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards Association. Just wanted to briefly talk about the phase-in. From 925 to 975, that's a 5% increase roughly. 975 to 1025, another 5% increase the next year. Typically, what we get from the state in funding allows districts to work between 0 and 3% with our bargaining units. Included in I know legislative fiscal looked and pulled some records from ODE on wages and included some of the roll-up costs. That number in roll-ups, which includes PERS, FICA, workers' comp, doesn't even include health care. School district business officials use 33 to 35%. The other related cost to this is going to impact our bargaining. We're going to have to continue to bargain when something comes up and touches a salary schedule. That ripple effect, I think, has been mentioned a few times. When a classified staff is historically seeing somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 3%, and the peers are receiving 5% below them with this minimum wage increase. Just have to bring it up again. The classroom's going to suffer. These are dollars that aren't going to go to the classroom to help students succeed, and districts probably have to look at their workforce as well and how to deal with the cost. That's all I got.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, all three of you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Elizabeth Nardi, Andrea Miller, and you have a worker with you, Andrea. Elizabeth, welcome.
Sure. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Nardi. I'm Director of Operations at New Seasons Market, a grocery chain in Portland, Oregon. We opened our first store 16 years ago, and today we have 16 stores in Oregon employing over 3,000 employees and one of the state's largest private employers. Recently, we've become very concerned with the cost of living in Oregon, particularly in the Portland metro area where our stores are located. With housing costs skyrocketing, many of our staff are not able to make ends meet. As a company deeply committed to progressive compensation, we've had to face the reality that even with our best intentions, our wages are not keeping up. That's why New Seasons Market made the decision to raise our starting wage to $12 an hour on January 1st of this year. And that's why I'm here today to offer testimony in support of your bill, Senate Bill 1532. You'll hear from opponents, and you've heard today, that businesses can't support and can't afford to raise the wages, but our experience shows that that simply is not true. Groceries are a very low margin industry, but time and time again, we've found that when we raise our wages, our morale goes up and the result is a boom to our bottom line when our turnover decreases. In fact, our turnover rate is significantly lower than many of our competitors, in large part because of our commitment to progressive compensation. I'm here today to advocate for broader public policy solution to increase the minimum wage in Oregon following three common sense principles. First, just as the case for raising the minimum wage is very clear, so too is the need to ensure that businesses have a level playing field for competition. Individual employers cannot move to $15 on their own if they must compete against other companies whose wages are subsidized by taxpayer-funded public assistance programs. The tide must rise for all ships, which is why statewide public policy is the right path forward. Second, minimum wage policy should account for the differences between both urban and rural economies. We support a path to $15 an hour in Portland. We also understand that the cost of living is very different in rural communities. As a company that partners with growers and producers all over the state, this issue is truly of the utmost importance to us. We urge the legislature to enact policy that takes these regional differences into account. Third, minimum wage increases should be phased in, as in Seattle and San Francisco. Ultimately, thank you for inviting my testimony. Thank you for your work on this important issue.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth.
Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Andrea Miller. I am the executive director of CAUSA. It's an organization that has advocated on behalf of Latino families for over 20 years, and you'll hear more from some of my colleagues here after me. You know, as you know, CAUSA strongly supports increasing the minimum wage, and most notably because our stagnant wages have disproportionately impacted communities of color. When you just look at Multnomah County, for example, where communities of color represent 28% of the county, they actually represent 44% of those that live in poverty. And you know, you look at it even more specifically, 36% of African Americans live in the county that live in poverty, 35% of Native Americans, 35% of Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders, and 31% of Latinos. And it's just not acceptable for us to continue this cycle of poverty for predominantly communities of color. In addition to that, 45% of Latinos work in low-wage industries statewide. It's pretty phenomenal. So I want to speak quickly to the governor's proposed minimum wage increase. And while it's not everything that we've been advocating for, as you know, we've been advocating for $13.50 with a quicker phase-in, but we do appreciate that she has taken in consideration both the business and labor side, and we think it's heading in the right direction for two reasons. One is we do see that it will provide a significant increase for workers over time, you know, a significant increase that will work to address the racial wage gap that we see in Oregon that has kept our growing communities of color at the bottom of the economic ladder. But most importantly, it doesn't include exemptions for certain workers or a training wage. And, you know, we think it's really important to maintain the integrity of Oregon's current minimum wage law. We've never had these type of exemptions, and we never should in the future. Because I think of people like Susanna. We work with a lot of young workers. A lot of them come from immigrant families.
You could conclude.
And we want to maintain, you know, the integrity of the law. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we think the governor's proposal is going in the right way.
Okay, thank you. Welcome. If you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Hello, my name is Jose Arredondo, everybody. And I'm 26, and I'm from Salem, and I've been living here all my life. This is my younger brother, Ramon. We have both been farm workers since we were children. We have done various jobs in rain or shine, such as picking strawberries, cherries, blackberries, grapes, blueberries, and most recently, planting hazelnut trees and Christmas tree baling. It's all part of the work we do seasonally with our parents, and me and Ramon can both attest to how physically demanding the work is and how difficult it is in terms of economic stability, especially for my parents. Me and my brother both consider ourselves proud farm workers, and it has been frustrating in recent years to think that most basic worker rights don't apply to farm workers. I'm glad that the minimum wage is now starting to be implemented for them, but at the same time, I completely disagree with the notion of a training wage for youth and farm workers as part of the minimum wage bill. The reason is because in the farm worker sector, there's a lot of jumping around job to job, and they all vary in the amount of work to be done. Some don't even last 2 weeks in duration. So if a training period were to be implemented, I would never get a minimum wage as a farm worker in the first place.
Thank you very much.
Hello. My name is Ramon Arredondo. I'm 24 years old, and I'm from Salem, Oregon. Like my brother Jose, I'm proud to identify myself as a farm worker. I've been farm working for over 12 years. I've always thought of the work as humbling and difficult, and that the people who do the work should at least be getting paid minimum wage. Doing this kind of work alongside our parents has made us appreciate and respect them more than ever, because we realize how difficult the work is and how hard it would be to maintain a family under such conditions. Farm workers work in all sorts of conditions. Last summer, my mom fell off a ladder picking cherries. The winter before that, my parents were hauling Christmas trees in the cold winter in December. So it's very hard conditions that they're working under. I'm very happy that farm workers are going to be included in the minimum wage bill, but I do not think it is fair to have a training wage for youth and farm workers implemented with it. The problem with this stipulation as it pertains to farm workers is that farm work is seasonal and inconsistent work. For example, you could be working in the fields for one farmer 1 month, and then the next month you're working for a different farmer. If the employee of the employer of a farm worker has the ability to put a training wage in place, then they could hold the farm worker in a training wage until the work is done. And when the work is done, then the farm worker would never get the minimum wage to begin with. Basically, this sort of thing incentivizes employers to further take advantage of their employees.
Thank you very much. Jose, Ramon, Elizabeth, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, our next panel, Ken Goh, Ryan Bond, and Steve Buckstein, please. Mr. Goh, is it?
Yes.
Yes. Do you want to start? And just a sec. Ryan Bond, again. Go ahead.
Yeah, he's in the other room. Thank you, Senator Demereau and everyone else. I'm a fourth-generation farmer from the Hood River Valley. Our family has been farming since...
Oh, excuse me. If you could give us your name for the
record. Excuse me. Kenneth Goh.
Thank you, Ken.
I'm a fourth-generation farmer from the Hood River Valley. Our family's been farming in Hood River since 1915. We currently have six full-time employees. Some of those have worked for us for 35 years. We consider them a part of our family. I've known two of these individuals longer than my 26-year-old daughter. Like I said, they are part of our family. This wage increase... even though all employees on our farm make more than the minimum wage, this wage increase would force out and consolidate these small farms in Hood River to larger corporate farms. As the fellow said earlier today, it would further change the landscape of Hood River Valley. It's a beautiful place to live. It's a beautiful place to grow fruit, but it would definitely change the landscape as development would come in as farmers went out of business. I know a lot of the people here today promoting this wage increase, they enjoy the family farm. They enjoy buying local and sustainability. But the problem is these wage increases, as we cannot control our price for our product, it's law of supply and demand. It just makes it harder and harder for us to compete. This wage increase would also drive out the independence of the family farm. I remember picking strawberries as a kid, you know, 6, 7 years old. I'm sure a lot of people in the room today had the same experience. I can't imagine myself as a 7 or 8 year old kid. Of course, we can't do that anymore because we can't do it that young. But my point is a young child starting out their first job. I can't imagine them being worth as much as a young adult working in any kind of industry, as far as that goes. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Mr. Bond.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Ryan Bond. I'm a cherry farmer from the Dalles, Oregon. I started in agriculture 25 years ago when I'd walk to the neighbors as a kid, pick vegetables, and I made minimum wage. 5 years ago, I was able to start my own company, start leasing my own orchard. I work for a fairly large orchard in the Dalles as well. We have probably 25 or 30 full-time employees. None of those people currently make minimum wage. Probably 80% of them have housing provided. If you don't live on the farm, we pay you a higher wage to account for not having housing. 20% of our employees receive company vehicles. However, next year, increase in the minimum wage, we're not going to notice it. It's already figured in. I mean, we already pay above that. And I do know that in 2022, with my small 30-acre farm that I lease, just the wage increase will be roughly $60,000. That's not including taxes. That's not including the paid sick time. That's not including any of that. And if that's to happen, I will no longer have a farm. I cannot absorb those costs, and everything I've worked for the past 24 years will be for naught. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Buckstein.
Chair Denborough, members of the committee, I'm Steve Buckstein. I'm senior policy analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute, a Portland-based think tank. I'm here to oppose Senate Bill 1532, not so much because of the details, but on principle. Submitted longer written testimony on OLIS, and just want to give you a few reasons why I'm opposed to it. I was once accused in this building, actually on the other side of the building, of being in favor of slavery because of slave wages, because I was not in favor of the minimum wage policy as a concept. I can assure you I've never been in favor of any form of slavery or coercion. But while wanting people to earn more money is commendable, and I think you all want people at the lower levels to earn more money, forcing employers to pay workers more than they can afford or more than it may be worth to their business is not commendable. I've long pointed out the negative effects of raising Oregon's minimum wage, and you've heard these before. Younger workers, less educated, lower skilled workers may lose their jobs or not gain jobs in the first place. Some employers will be forced to hire fewer workers, let some workers go, raise prices for their customers. Yes, some workers will benefit from an increase in the minimum wage, but the practical effects of raising the minimum wage, whether they're good or whether they're bad, don't change the fact that demanding some people earn more at the expense of others is not a moral action. I'm under no illusions that my statements here are going to change anybody's mind. If you're in favor of raising the minimum wage, you're not going to abandon your thoughts just because of my statements. But I think that you should think about the costs to people, the unintended consequences. When you help some people, you're hurting others. I simply want it on the record that I view the minimum wage as a way to pervert compassion into coercion. And finally, rather than raise Oregon's minimum wage, what I would suggest, and again, I know you're not going to do this, but you should do the moral thing and end the policy altogether so that we can get into a more productive discussion of ways to help lower-income workers in a moral way without hurting others. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, all three of you. Colleagues, I'm going to bring up one more panel. I know some of you are going to have to leave other committees, but and these will be Roger Lee, John Stark, and Susanna Morgan. And for the rest of you, I'm really sorry that I couldn't get to you. I can just assure you that as many people on one side of the issue as on the other are not able to testify. But the record is going to be open until 5 o'clock. If you haven't submitted written testimony, please do. Also, let me say that if this bill does go to the floor of the Senate for a vote, and if it's passed out, it will go to the House, and you'll have another opportunity to testify over there. So,
Chairman, members of the committee here, thanks for having me testify. Roger Lee with Economic Development for Central Oregon. I think the only economic development person to speak today. It seems to be a lot of talk about counting of votes for this package, and maybe not so much on the accounting of the impacts. So just some questions on that. We've seen estimates from 30,000 to 50,000. I didn't hear the 62.5 for jobs lost. If you look at the Portland, Eugene, basically all the metros in the state, including Medford, Bend, Corvallis, and Salem, if you add up all those jobs of the last decade, say 2004 to 2014, it's about that 60,000 jobs. So that's what we've losses and gains in that period of time. It's not inconsequential as far as the job losses, I think, that could see be seen from this. And I guess I have to ask the question of, has there, the negotiations that have kind of come to this? I've seen press about this, about, business groups. Well, I know it's not the Chambers of Commerce. I know it's not economic development organizations or the restaurant and lodging groups. It's not farmers and food processors. It's not small businesses. So I'm just curious to know maybe how some of this policy was developed around, you know, and some of the methodology and some of the logic and economics behind it. And then last, I would say, just question maybe, is it good policy to really have something that's so impactful to the state, so impactful for our economy, which really is responsible for producing the general fund through personal income taxes, without some partisanship support, without at least one, somebody else across the aisle who's willing to support it? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is John Stark. I am the senior manager for Redmond Economic Development, a nonprofit economic development agency focused on traded sector business development. We're in Redmond. We have 120 businesses that we work with. This increase, you've heard this several times, will cost will increase the cost of doing business in Oregon, making our businesses and our state less competitive. At least two businesses in Redmond are considering operations in other states as a result of this legislation. I've submitted written testimony from one of them. We have recruiters from other states already visiting Central Oregon. They're preying on this frustration, opportunities to operate in other low-cost states. One business has already sent jobs to Arizona as a result of other cost-increasing legislation around the sick leave policy. Let's let these businesses spread their wings, hit their stride in this improving economy. They will create wealth for all of us in the state of Oregon. Instead of raising wages, let's give Oregonians the training they need to secure a better job and earn a higher wages on their own. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stark. Welcome, Susanna.
Chair Demro, members of the committee, my name is Susanna Morgan. I'm the CEO of Oregon Food Bank. Oregon Food Bank's mission is to eliminate hunger and its root causes. We are a nonpartisan nonprofit organization with a sole focus on ending hunger. When I joined the organization 3 years ago, we looked at what we were doing that was causing hunger within our own organization, and we raised our own internal minimum wage to 185% of poverty for a family of two, or about $14 an hour. So when this conversation came up, we felt we couldn't stay silent. We had done the work to determine that income is a major cause of hunger, which at this point in time stands at 800,000 Oregonians who are facing hunger, nearly half of whom have income earners in their household. So we very much support an increase in the minimum wage. However, we also think about the root causes of hunger, and one of the biggest root causes of hunger are lack of jobs at a living wage, and the health and strength of our rural economies. So we also support a measured and moderate increase in the minimum wage with times for businesses to adjust and change in implementation in the rural and urban areas. Because of this approach, we support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susanna. Thank you, all three of you. So, colleagues, we have this posted for a work session on Thursday. We've heard that there's a Dash 4 amendment. We'll post it as soon as we get it. If there are any other amendments out there, I'd ask that we get them before, I mean, ideally 24 hours in advance, so we have time to ruminate over them. And again, for those of you who are here to testify, sorry we couldn't get to you. We did get to everyone who came over 100 miles, so that's something. Thank you for your attention and great decorum here. Take care. With that, I will close this public hearing, and we are adjourned. This public hearing.